You're listening to In Your Company on Cambridge 105.
Welcome to In Your Company, the fortnightly business show on Cambridge 105, presented by me, Sam Davis. In our last show, we featured Cambridgeshire County Council's Destination Digital Initiative. This is a scheme which offers SMEs financial support and business advice with the goal of improving their participation in the digital economy. Today, we follow up on that theme by talking to a variety of experts about what you should or could do to enhance your business's online presence. The latest figures are impressive. They suggest that the digital economy now accounts for £120 billion per annum, which represents 8% of the UK's GDP. It also shows that SMEs with a well-developed web presence can grow between 4 and 8 times faster than those without. So it really can be worth taking the plunge. My first contributor is Gori Yahya, who leads what is known as Google's Juice Bar initiative. The Juice Bar came to Cambridge last Friday in an event introduced by Cambridge MP Julian Huppert. Catching a few minutes with Gori after his presentation, I asked him to explain what the Juice Bar was all about.
So the Google Juice Bar is a series of workshops and events. It's part of a Google initiative to help SMBs really kind of grasp the internet and help grow them, grow their digital presence. We've been really aiming to kind of give a lot of SMBs the digital skills they need and to increase the digital maturity and just take advantage of the web to help harness growth for their business.
And you're running these sessions all over the country, I gather?
Yeah, we've been doing this for probably about 3 years now, working literally across the country, UK-wide. Literally just working with different initiatives and, bringing together local SMBs where possible to help them, with their businesses.
So one of the things you talked about that I thought was really interesting was how a business's presence online needs to express personality. And that might be a slightly abstract concept for some people. How does a business go about expressing a personality online without being childish, if you like? Unless, of course, that's appropriate.
Well, it depends on what kind of business you are. There's certain people who have, for example, a photographer, can just, tweet as themselves quite easily. But somebody who sells a particular kind of product online may find it a little bit more challenging to show a certain kind of personality. But, essentially, if they are at the helm, the person is, or whoever is at the helm of the business, they want to show that a business can be contactable, and can be in a conversation. And anybody in a conversation really should be able to, showcase some kind of persona.
The contactability thing is a theme which I think is getting more and more coverage about how far work invades people's personal lives these days. Now, clearly as an SME owner or employee, you might expect that you're going to have to put a lot of hours in. But doesn't the whole kind of online world that these businesses have to inhabit mean that trend is really exacerbated? You talked about the need to be responsive. Is that not just sucking people into being always on?
Well, it's interesting. So, one of the greatest things about having a digital presence is that it's available, that you are available, your business is available 24/7. It's not a shop front that's open 9 to 5. If anybody wants to get access to your product, for example, they can get access to your products at any time of the day. Now, if you're looking to offer that service and you are quite keen to grow your business in that way, then you have to have some sort of service available then. So if somebody has a question for you and they're struggling to buy something, a lot of people can look into an automated response system that allows them to respond to questions and say, we'll respond to you within a number of hours or a day or so. And that allows you to manage your time a little bit easier.
And as you've explained very clearly today, Google has lots of tools at people's disposal to help them manage that effort, one of which is a thing that I hadn't come across before, Google Trends. Can you talk a little bit how about an SME owner might use Google Trends to sharpen up what they're doing?
Sure. So Google Trends is it's basically a way that Google has indexed the way people have been searching and showcased the search data. So if, for example, I am somebody who sells Christmas trees, I think it was an example I used earlier, I can now search for that term in Google Trends, google.com/trends, to see how often people have been searching for that product, or when in the year people have been searching for that. And that allows me to see perhaps where the trends are coming from. Another example is if I sell, I may be someone who makes leather jackets or customizes, you know, different kinds of dresses. I can now see what kinds of dresses are really big in the media or really big or really highly searched for, and now make sure that I'm part of that trend. Or if there's a declining trend, maybe I should be pulling out of that and putting more investment into other areas that I sell. So again, it's a free tool. You can literally, anybody can log on to Google Trends and just search for a new product and work out exactly how people are searching for their products.
And Google's also putting a lot of emphasis, I gather, into localization. So how to get search results that are really specific to where you are, if that's important to you. Mm-hmm. What kind of ways should people be trying to harness that to promote their business?
Well, for any businesses, for example, they've seen themselves as a marker on Google Maps, but haven't, for example, taken advantage of claiming that presence, is a really great way to really claim and verify your listening. So you can add as much information as you can to that listening. It's very easy to do. Again, as I was mentioning before, Google My Business is a simpler way for you to be able to manage your presence on Google. But by adding really accurate information, such as where your address is, making sure that your marker is in the correct location, it just allows people to get the right kind of information, and hopefully they will make the right decisions based on you providing more information for them.
When you were talking in your presentation about how to put information across on your company's website, some of it did strike me as being not that different from the kinds of preoccupations you might have with your offline marketing. So things like making sure that your call to action is clear, making sure that your branding is appropriate, that people can see the logo, that they know how to contact you. There's a lot of similarities. What are the differences with online marketing?
But there are actually probably a lot more similarities than there are differences. I think the difference with being online is that everything in digital is accountable. So you can now, you know, understand when people get to your webpage, where they go. You know, are certain aspects of your content less engaging than others? You know, can you improve that? You know, can you improve your user experience? Certain things that perhaps you may not be able to do as easily offline, it just allows you to do it more easily online.
If people want to find out more about the Google Juice Bar initiative, how should they go about finding it out?
Well, we actually created a page for this event, which has some really lovely resources on there as well, which was events.withgoogle.com/google-juice-bar-cambridge, if you can remember that. And that tells us, that will allow you to get more access to information about the resource that we're giving here. And we also have links to other events that we'll be doing, and hopefully we'll be doing more nearby. It's actually a real pleasure to work with Julian today and bringing it to Cambridge as well. So I'm actually very, very pleased to be able to be in Cambridge. It's our first time to Cambridge, so very excited.
I then went on to speak to one of the participants at the Juice Bar event, Kelly Drury, who's managing consultant at business psychologist Talent Glue. And I asked her about her reasons for attending.
I'm just really interested to hear from the people that are developing all the tools at Google, really how they see individuals and sort of bigger businesses, how they actually go about using those different tools, and really understanding from them directly, because they're designing the tools, things like AdWords, things like Google Analytics. We kind of know these things are there, but really understanding a bit more about how you use the information and how you get the insight to actually get to your customers and really know who they are.
So your business, Talent Glue, has a website.
Yes.
What degree of functionality do you currently have on that?
So it's a WordPress based site, and it does have interactive features. It's linked to my social different forms of social media, so you can link through to Twitter and various things on it, and you can also complete sort of surveys and sort of self-assessment tools and all those good things that psychologists are known for. So it does have quite a lot of interactive functionality already, but I was really keen to understand a bit more about how to maximise people being on my site.
And if there's one lesson that you took away from today, what would it be?
I think there's so much out there with social media that it can get a little bit overwhelming. So finding ways to link as many of your different tools together as possible. So being able to manage your Google Plus profile and sort of link that to your blog posts or linking that to Twitter directly, so you just having to create one piece of content and then push the button once rather than many times. And I think that was really insightful from today.
This is In Your Company on Cambridge 105 with me, Sam Davis. The Google Juice Bar provided me with a great introduction to how any small business can use digital tools to hone its operations. But my next interviewee has taken a much more ambitious approach to exploiting the digital opportunity. Vivian Chan is the CEO and co-founder of Sparrow. This provides a specialist search engine for the scientific research community based on its unique ability to distill and distribute information on the latest developments relative to each scientist's field. She came into the studio to talk me through its origins and scope. Vivian, your company Sparrow is doing something very exciting. Can you start by explaining to us what it is you're all about?
Yeah, sure. So first off, thank you very much for having me. So Sparrow is a recommendation engine for science. And taking a step back, I guess I always call myself as a scientist turned accidental entrepreneur. And I'll give you a bit of a background of how I became, you know, an entrepreneur and how I started Sparrow. I was doing my PhD here at Cambridge in Ben Lacy's lab, and I discovered a problem. I found that staying on top using search engines and repetitive search over PubMed, over Google Scholar, over Proteome databases was just quite repetitive.
So this is the notion that as a PhD scientist, you have to prove that you have mastery of everything that's being published in your field. That's what you mean by staying on top.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you first start off a PhD, your supervisor tells you what you should be reading and you do a literature review. And then you're meant to come up with innovative research so that you can actually publish. And I guess that's the kind of success matrix of a scientist or researcher to a certain degree is the type of publications that you actually produce. And so therefore, in order to make novel research, you need to make sure you have read everything else that is out there. And that is just millions of data out there.
In your lab at the time, you had access to something which was a kind of de facto solution to this problem.
Yeah, exactly. Like every other research lab, and I think inherently why research was built around research groups, is that there's a good wealth of people that kind of all do similar stuff. And inherently you have journal clubs and you have weekly journal clubs where people would present an interesting research paper that has recently been published and talk about that and see whether that's interesting for the research group and how that impacts on everyone's individual research. Then you also have PubMed and other great wealth of databases that you generally should be keeping on top of. And people do subscribe to, you know, weekly alerts and stuff like that. But I just found as a researcher, I just didn't have time.
What kind of volume of papers would be coming up in, let's say, a week or a month through those sources that you had to try and...
Quite a lot, because you want to put in as many keywords that is relevant to you. And also, sometimes every single week or every single month, the project changes slightly, and you might be wanting to look at new methods and looking at how other people are crystallizing things to give you new inspiration. So the wealth of knowledge every single week on Fridays, I think I remember getting PubMed alerts, and it was always maxed out to 20 or if not 10 to 20 new articles. And those emails would just start piling up in my inbox because I'm like, oh, we'll get to those. I will get to those one day. But then I guess I found Postdoc Steve.
Yes. Now, Postdoc Steve is a key player in the development of Sparrow.
Correct.
Do you want to explain about him?
Postdoc Steve is my inspiration, I guess. And not just on this project in Sparrow, but he helped me a lot through my PhD. But what I found was that he was a really good postdoc researcher, and he would spend maybe about 10 or 15 minutes every morning reading the head of prints of the 3 or 5 journals that he thought was really relevant to the research group. And then that's how he would read and stay on top for himself. But more importantly, he knew what everyone else in the research group was working on and could serendipitously recommend to us what it is that we should be reading. So, for example, we'd be like, oh, I knew you had this problem with protein degradation last week. Check out this paper. It's just been released. See if you can get anything out of it. It's really interesting techniques. And that's where that serendipity comes in. And that, I think, is really hard to find using linear keyword searches.
So the idea came to you then that what you needed to create was a digital Steve.
Correct. Exactly. I guess it all dawned on me that that's how we stayed on top. And then I obviously lived with other PhD students, and they, you know, they kind of joked that they didn't have Steve. And then when I met my co-founder, who also had the same problem when he was studying machine learning and computer science, I told him about postdoc Steve, and he said, you know what? We could try something. Let's build Digital Steve. Let's see whether or not we can actually build a digital technology platform that enables more people like Steve to start joining the dots and recommend serendipitous papers. Cross-discipline, really.
So like all the best companies, Sparrow was started to solve a problem, to meet a need, and it was a need that you had direct experience of. When did all of this happen? What time frame are we talking about?
So I finished my PhD 2012 now, and I knew this was a massive problem, and I was trying to replicate Steve to many degree, but I didn't really know how, and I didn't know whether or not what entrepreneurship really was. I was part of the Cambridge University Technology and Enterprise Club. I was present there, so I got exposed to quite a lot of entrepreneurship, and that got me thinking about whether I could do something about the problem I personally had. And then it wasn't until I actually met my co-founder and he gave me the technical kind of reassurance of background that we could do something, that kind of kick-started, I guess, a venture now, an exciting startup. And the time frame of that, the company has, I've been then working and just iterating and fleshing out what the actual solutions, possible alternative solutions would be to this one problem. And I talked to a lot of my friends, and I talked to a lot of other PhD students, and fleshed out, you know, a minimum viable product to which I can then actually pitch to investors and managed to get funding to kickstart and incorporate the company. So the Sparrow, the company behind Sparrow has actually been incorporated July 2013. And so now it's been going for 1 year and 3 months.
And I think there are 6 of you involved at this stage, is
correct,
that right?
Exactly. It's been an exciting period of time since then. And I've built a stellar team. A team of 6 now. And everyone is absolutely great scientists, with a huge amount of commercial and startup experience. And I think if it wasn't for them, my idea, or let alone the product that was built to solve the problem, wouldn't be what it is right now.
And I think one of the things which exemplifies the digital opportunity is the fact that Sparrow was started to address this issue of staying on top of published material. Mm-hmm. But the way you've described it to me, you can now see how it will act to aggregate all sorts of other material which is relevant to people around the subject of their research, but drawing it in from many, many sources.
Correct. We realise that we can actually aggregate so much disparate type of scientific sources out there. There's a huge amount of publications, which is already a pain to stay on top of. But as researchers, especially in this modern day research, not everything's just in publications anymore. There's a huge amount of wealth in patents. There's conference posters. And there's now even repositories like Figshare that allow people to submit just data sets. So we are now working on the diversity, aggregation of diversity of content that is going to be really, really valuable to any level of researcher. And we'll be pulling on videos and podcasts in the near future as well, because this is a recommendation. It is first step we aggregate, then we distill, and then using our recommendation engine and allowing the user to interact with the pieces of content on a very personalized level, where they can indicate at every single piece of content whether it's relevant or not relevant to them. It is, in a way, training their own Steve. And that is pretty much the best kind of solution we have.
And yet, when you look at your website, which is Sparrow, sparrow.com,
yeah,
the whole thing is so sparse and so pared down. The impression you give is one of immense simplicity, and I assume that's deliberate.
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's not the greatest in terms of pretty design, but that is also strategic, because the most amount of value we see is ensuring that we bring the right content to the right people at the right time without having them to, you know, sign up for registration first. It's pretty much allowing the users to understand what the USP is and find interesting content that they otherwise wouldn't have searched for or didn't know that existed. So, for example, we do have research grants on there. We have people using it saying we didn't even know that those were actually public, and let alone recommending it next to an interesting poster conference that I didn't know existed as well.
What do you think the limits of the scope of this could be? I mean, is this something which is always just going to be bound in the scientific community? It sounds like the kind of tool which would be useful in the real world, if you like, yeah, as well.
Yeah, so I guess we realised that staying on top of science was beyond academic researchers. And so now we even have users like patent attorneys, consultants, investors, conference organisers, all using the tool to stay on top. So it got us thinking that the actual problem goes beyond and includes industry and private sectors. So we even have enterprises now coming to us saying we do a lot of international R&D. There's no way for us, our employees, to even stay on top. So that's one aspect of where the company will be growing. And you're spot on. There is huge amount of data that goes beyond just science, and that we've already had interest in other sectors about how we can actually employ the recommendation, personalised recommendation, to allow the bigger data sets of the world to be discoverable.
Well, it's a huge privilege to be able to talk to you this early on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
In the journey of your company. And who knows, maybe you're Cambridge's very own Facebook entrepreneur in the making.
Let's hope so. You've heard it here first.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Our final destination on today's whistle-stop tour of all things digital is Bitcoin. Many people will have heard of it in the context of a possible future ubiquitous digital currency. But until this week, I hadn't taken the next step of investigating a little further where it's come from and where it's going. To improve my understanding, I went along to a meeting run by local business networking group Chase, which was dedicated to the topic of Bitcoin.
I'm with Freya Stevens from an organisation called Coinapult, which is a Bitcoin... Now, how am I supposed to describe this? Wallet provider.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, I've just sat through 2 hours worth of discussion about Bitcoin, which has taken my understanding from zero to something, which is progress.
That's good.
But for people who haven't had the benefit of sitting through this conversation, could you do a 1-minute summary of what Bitcoin is, first of all?
It is a distributed asset ledger. So you're already giving me that look. What it allows people to do is it allows you to send value from one place to another. This could be anywhere in the world, without the need for a third party.
No banks.
So somebody has solved this problem in cryptography, basically. So it allows you to do this now, whereas in the past, this was the problem nobody could get around.
And one of the things that I have been aware of about Bitcoin in the past is that it's had a very bad reputation of being used to support all sorts of illegal or semi-legal type operations. Now, presumably, you and the proponents of this scheme see a whole lot of legitimate uses for it.
Yes, I mean, I think you're referring to Silk Road.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So that was a minnow in the terms of the ocean of transactions that happen every day. Bitcoin itself, even in its whole entirety of how many transactions are taking place, is still very small compared to what's happening with the MasterCards and the Visas of this world. And what I would say is. That one incident looks very good in the press. So obviously they like to pick that up and run with it. But
I think also it's more broadly the notion that something which is, as you say, unscrutinised, unmanaged and can be anonymous must therefore lend itself to dubious purposes.
I would say that cash can also be anonymous and lend itself to dubious purposes. So I would say that argument isn't quite as valid as some might make it out to be.
Okay, so looking positively at Bitcoin, it's been slow to be adopted, I think, within the UK, certainly slower than in other developing economies where they might have more neat of this kind of finance system. And in Cambridge, I think you put up a slide saying that there were about 5 organisations that currently accept Bitcoin. Now, what kind of motivations might they have for taking it up, other than curiosity and a little bit of frivolity?
There are some very real benefits to merchants accepting Bitcoin. The biggest one is the transaction fees are very low. So typically with credit card fees, you're paying 3-4%. With Bitcoin, it's basically next to nothing. I couldn't tell you the exact, I'm not sure of the exact cost, but we're talking barely anything. We're talking like a couple of pence maybe on a £20 transaction.
Similarly, why would a UK consumer want to adopt Bitcoin given the relatively few outlets that they can use it in at the moment?
That's a really good question, and one that comes up time and time again. Speaking personally, I like to use Bitcoin because it's fun and I'm pretty geeky, and I think actually Bitcoin is limited to people who are intrigued by the technology at the moment. In terms of getting broader mainstream consumer adoption, I don't think that's going to happen until we can present Bitcoin in a much more user-friendly way. But having said that, there's a lot of innovation happening around the technology of Bitcoin, not just for financial transactions, but looking beyond that to see how the technology can be used for digital contracts, which includes things like voting fairly building or anything you can sign as a contract, so deeds, right, wills. And I think that side of it is definitely going to be in the future but as a mainstream technology. But Bitcoin, the financial technology, I think that we've got a bit of work to do as an industry.
If you're interested in finding out more about Bitcoin, take a look at Freya's podcasts on bitcoinukmedia.com or go along to one of the regular Bitcoin meetups in Cambridge. You can find more information on this and all the other contributors to today's show via the In Your Company Twitter feed. So, many thanks to Gori, Kelly, Vivian and Freya for taking part. And if you have any queries or feedback, please email us at inyourcompany@cambridge105.fm. You can also follow us on Twitter at In Your Company. Remember that all previous editions of In Your Company are available as podcasts on the Cambridge 105 website. Next on Cambridge 105 is The Science Show with Roger Frost. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
You can never tell quite what you're going to get on a Saturday morning on Cambridge 105, especially between 10 o'clock and midday. Because it could be just me, Neil Whiteside, on my own, having a good time, 2 hours of Too Good To Be Forgotten. Classic oldies, usually from four separate decades. Or it could be me and the wife. 2 hours of husband and wife bickering, live from Gwydir Street, with stuff thrown in that she's organised. But just tune in, Saturday mornings, 10 till midday, Cambridge 105, community radio in your city, and see what we get.
Check out the 60s scene here on Cambridge 105. I'm John Gannon, and every week I'll be spinning a wide selection of 60 sounds to take you back in time to a golden decade. Join me on Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. right here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.